I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, our President's Day conversation. How did past presidents fare when they inherited a war? But first, President Bush came down on the side of the new Republic of Kosovo today, saying the Kosovars are now independent. But what does that mean? The U.S. recognition of yesterday's Declaration of Independence by the former Yugoslavian territory of Kosovo was followed by a statement from the European Union saying that member countries are free to recognize Kosovo as well. But officials in Russia and Serbia remain outraged. They called the Kosovo declaration illegal. Well, Kosovo has been formally part of Serbia, but under UN and NATO administration since 1999, when NATO airstrikes ended former Yugoslav leader Slobodan Milosevic. Milosevic's 10-year crackdown on Kosovo's last separatist movement. Ed Lucas writes for The Economist magazine. Ed, Kosovo did not go to the UN. The country's leaders wrote over 100 letters directly to other countries. Is there a legal question here?
Well, there's always a legal question, but ultimately Kosovo's status isn't about international law, it's about international politics, and what we're seeing is a standoff with America on one side, Russia on the other, and Europe divided in the middle. And that's pretty dismal. It means we've not got a great chance of making Kosovo work, and we've got every chance of conflict spreading to other places in the Balkans.
Well, there's question as to whether Kosovo will be welcomed into the broader European Union, but when you speak of the middle, Spain, for instance, is nervous about its own separatist movement.
That's right. Well, lots of European countries have got worries about this. And so Greece is worried because they have Muslim and Slav-speaking populations in the north. Romania's worried because they've got a Hungarian minority. Slovakia's worried because they've got a Hungarian minority. So we're seeing it's a classic example of Europe's disunity in the face of a foreign policy challenge, which is really depressing, but it's not for the first time.
And Russia, of course, is outraged because of separatist movements in Georgia and Chechnya.
Well, Russia is worried because it itself is vulnerable to this. Russia's like a Swiss cheese with all sorts of minorities, some of which people may have heard of, like the Tatars, some of which have rather exotic names, like the Udmurts, who we haven't heard of perhaps so much. But in a multi-ethnic country like Russia, and particularly with these minorities often having much faster birth rates than Russians, the Slav Russians do themselves, Russia's quite vulnerable to this. Russia doesn't want separatism to become a precedent, and that's one of the reasons why they're making such a fuss about this now. But, of course, the big reason is because it embarrasses the West, which is the central feature of Putin's foreign policy, is divide and rule wherever he can.
Well, Kosovo is made up largely of ethnic Albanians, secular Muslims. We've seen the pictures of them cheering wildly, celebrating their declared separation from Serbia, which is largely Christian Orthodox. But there is a Serb population in Kosovo not happy with the Declaration of Independence. What happens to them?
Well, this is really going to be the crunch in the short term. The northern chunk of Kosovo, north of a river, the Ida River, is mainly Serb. There are very few Albanians living there. And the Serbian government has set up offices there. It's saying it's going to continue to treat this as de jure part of Serbia. And the big question will come when the authorities in Pristina, the Albanian authorities, try and exert some form of government force there. If they send their police there, maybe with international backing, trying to catch criminals or to perform any other public services, what happens? And that's going to be really tricky, and I think we may end up with a kind of de facto partition of Kosovo. It won't make anything more stable, but I think that's where we're heading.
Is there a fear that we may be heading back to the late 1980s through 99, through a bloody crackdown?
There's a real worry about that, because the whole carefully stitched together peace settlement in the Balkans is coming apart. Bosnia is in a real mess now. So the Bosnian Serbs are now out on a limb, maybe going to go in with Serbia under its nationalist prime minister. We've got Macedonia, which is divided deeply between a Slavic Macedonian population and the Albanians. There's quite a possibility that the Albanians are going to say, let's have a greater Albania. Why don't we put all these Albanian populations together in one kind of country or confederation? It's not on the agenda now, but logically it's certainly a question they'll be considering in the future.
Well, in the meantime, as you said, there's been failed negotiations for quite a while now, and Kosovo propped up in many ways by other countries. Is it thought that Kosovo is capable of handling independence?
Well, Kosovo is quite a mess at the moment. There's no doubt about that. And international rule has not produced a sort of poster child, to put it mildly. There's big problems with organised crime, bad infrastructure, bad public services, all the sort of things one gets in the sort of semi-failing states of Eastern Europe. And it's going to be a big challenge just to try and make it work. And my worry is that the international context is so unstable and so quarrelsome that the chances of actually making Kosovo work as a country are pretty slim and diminishing.
Well, and of course, the hope that that's not true. Ed Lucas of The Economist magazine, also author of the book The New Cold War, Putin's Russia and the Threat to the West. Ed, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin. Bye-bye.
Well, one thing's for certain. A year from now, a new American president will celebrate their first President's Day in the White House. What challenges will that person face? How will they deal with them? Well, history may be a guide. Julian Zelitzer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. He's co-editor of Rightward Bound, Making America Conservative in the 1970s. He joins us from the Princeton campus. Julian, welcome as always.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, you say there are five challenges. Some are obvious, but just tick them off for us.
Yeah, the major challenges, the first of the Iraq-Afghanistan wars, the next president will have to deal with what we do next. The second will be kind of rebuilding international support and international alliances. The third will probably be immigration. The fourth would be middle-class security, insecurity, really, economic issues like oil, housing, all the problems that are facing the middle class. And the final problem is the hardest problem. It's the unknown problem. It's the one all presidents confront. They don't know what it is yet, and it's really going to test their leadership.
It's the September 11th, perhaps, the something that happens. You also mentioned there's another one, bridging a divide between president and Congress. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I would add
no,
that.
That's all right.
We're at a moment when tensions between Congress and the executive branch are pretty bad. And I think the next president, Democrat or Republican, is going to face that reality on Capitol Hill.
Well, and we can look back to get references for all of these. Richard Nixon, when you come to point number one, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and divides between presidents and Congress, Richard Nixon inherited the war in Vietnam. Let's listen first to some sound from his inaugural address in 1969.
Standing in this same place, a third of a century ago, Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation ravaged by depression, gripped in fear. He could say, in surveying the nation's troubles, they concern, thank God, only material things. Our crisis today is in reverse. We find ourselves rich in goods, but ragged in spirit. Reaching with magnificent precision for the moon, but falling into raucous discord on Earth.
President Nixon there, obviously talking about the divisions caused by the Vietnam War. And Julian Zelitzer, we've spoken with you before about parallels between Vietnam and the war in Iraq. But you know, Congress eventually pushes Nixon to end the war. Today's Congress, with you know its small Democratic majority, has not been able to push Bush to end the war, but also some don't want to. There's a we broke it, we own it attitude. So similarities and differences.
Yeah, there's a lot of differences. I mean, one, polarization is much more intense on Capitol Hill, so it's harder to form the kind of bipartisan alliances that you saw in Nixon's era, the kind of alliances that put a lot of pressure on the president. You also have Democrats who are really still pretty divided over what to do. It's unclear both how to exit from Iraq and then what to do in the region more broadly. And finally, with narrow majorities, you know, the reality is in the next Congress, Republicans can still cause a lot of damage if they're in the minority on Capitol Hill, even with the United Government. So there's going to be a lot of constraints on the president if he is a Democrat or she is a Democrat in terms of what to do. And a Republican will face similar problems.
But what can presidents take from Nixon or other presidents who inherited war?
Well, Nixon's strategy, in part, was gradual. I mean, part of what he wants to get rid of Vietnam. He doesn't see it as good. He doesn't see it as a good war, and he sees it as a huge political problem. So one of the things he tries to do is gradually withdraw troops, and he embarks on a plan that lasts for years, where slowly American troops start to come home, and the war is turned over to the Vietnamese. And, you know, that is a model that we could look for. We've talked about immediate withdrawal or no withdrawal. There is another another option, and that might be something we can take from that presidency.
We want to look back to 1945 as well, because Harry Truman had only been vice president for about a year when President Roosevelt died. Truman had to take over and inherited a world of woe. In fact, we found that great quote from his exchange with Eleanor Roosevelt. Do you remember what she reportedly said when she came and said to him, "Harry, the president is dead"? And Truman said to Mrs. Roosevelt, "Is there anything I can do for you?" And she said, "Well, is there anything we can do for you? For you're the one in trouble now." Less than a month before the war in Europe was to end and World War II still raging in the Pacific, his challenge.
Yeah, I mean, that was a famous quote also, because Truman was kind of unknown. Most Americans didn't really know who he was and weren't sure he was capable of being president. So that's a famous quote that really captured the uncertainty and the challenges of the moment.
And how did he handle it?
Well, eventually, you know, he will end the war in Asia with as decisive an action as you can, dropping the atomic bomb. And his poll numbers will go up. The controversies that will later swirl around that decision don't exist at the time. But he does achieve a decisive and brutal victory. And that's how he handles it.
Well, you know, some of the conversation around ending Iraq has swirled around your number two, which is doing something to fix the anti-American sentiments around the world, reestablishing international contacts. Tell us, you know, how will this resonate with the next president?
That's, you know, that's one of the hardest challenges of all, because it doesn't just involve what the U.S. does, but it involves how other countries react. And this is going to be a test of the personal diplomatic skills of our next leader. That's something we should be looking for in these debates, in these primaries. You know, how is the next president going to be able to do in these one-on-one meetings with members of Europe who are still, many of them, angry with how the U.S. conducted this war, or other members of the Middle East? So that's going to be a kind of challenge. It isn't just about policy, but really about, you know, behind the scenes, how a person can interact with leaders of other countries.
Is there a president who did that, who repaired relations?
That's tough. Some say George Bush the first did some of that, you know, that after the end of the Cold War, we were in a kind of state of uncertainty. It was unclear what was going to have to happen after Reagan. And part of what happens in the first Persian Gulf War is that Bush is able to create a pretty strong international coalition for getting Hussein out of Kuwait. And some say that was one of his achievements, even though some of it's been undone.
Just real quick, we got about a minute before the break, but your third is, you know, kind of restoring the security of the middle class. Roosevelt is the one who said, "Let me assert my firm belief: the only thing we have to fear is fear itself." Of course, in 1933, who can the next president reach back to?
Well, I think, you know, if it's a Democrat, that's a good model. It's a different kind of economic situation. We're not in a huge depression like we were then. But there are those still fears among the middle class about what comes next. And he was an inspirational leader.
Some of the candidates are suggesting a sort of job corps to rebuild bridges, rebuild that middle class. Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson, co-editor of Rightward Bound, Making America Conservative in the 1970s. We'll take a minute break and come back and look at some of the other challenges he says the new president will face and how history may help us. And later in the program, presidential trivia. I'll give you a minute to think. Who was the first president born in the United States? We'll have the answer in 1 minute here and now. We're back with Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. On this President's Day, we've been looking back at history to see what lessons might be learned for the next American president. And Julian, I asked that question before the break. We have a segment coming up on someone who's put together a presidential trivia quiz. And I asked the question. This is very unfair, but it's a trick question. You know the answer? Who was the first president?
I don't know it offhand, to be honest.
It's a trick question. It was Martin Van Buren, because all the presidents before him were born in colonies.
Right.
That's really unfair. We'll have more questions for you later. But the questions we've been asking are what the next president might learn from past presidents. And we spoke of Roosevelt with his, you know, all the plans he launched in the 30s. There have been some candidates saying, well, what about a job corps? Talk of green jobs, people put to work rebuilding the U.S. or transferring energy sources from oil to solar. You know, can we reach back, or was that a one-time moment in American history?
that's a different era. I mean, that's in an era when liberalism was strong, when the belief in what government could do was much stronger than it is today. So it'd be hard to build, you know, not only a lot of Republican support, but Democratic support for some kind of job corps. Realistically, it's going to, you know, the modern age is about incentives, government subsidizing different forms of economic activity or mortgages. It's really about incentives and subsidies seems to be what modern liberalism is all about.
You know, you ticked five challenges that you thought the next American president might face. One of them was bridging the divide between the president and Congress. Does it matter that the next president will be a senator? Does that affect this issue?
Most likely it won't. I mean, I think once whoever is in the White House is in the White House, they're going to feel, you know, the pressure to expand presidential power. And because there's such tension with the legislative branch, I think the next president, if it's McCain or Clinton or Obama, you know, they're going to have a lot of interest to use the power of the presidency against Congress, even if they themselves came from that institution. So even though, you know, there's some reason to believe if you come from a certain body, you'll be more likely to deal with them, the trend in American history is toward more and more tension, regardless of who's in office.
Immigration, you say that's another challenge. Can we look back in history at that issue?
Sure. You know, we saw that many of the presidents in the early part of the 20th century dealt with immigration, and the resolution at that point was gradually to clamp down on immigration. And in the recent, so you had that every president in the first part through 1924 dealt with that. And now, you know, since the 1980s, including Reagan and Clinton, they have also dealt with the increase of immigration since 1965. But it's been more ambiguous in terms of what to do, even though they're sentiment for cracking down on the border, so to speak, it proves to be much harder politically because both parties are very divided over the issue these days.
Yeah. And finally, the unknown, you know, the one thing that each candidate and then the next president faces is the thing we can't describe, an unknown challenge.
Yeah, that's the hardest of all. Obviously, the current president faces that with 9/11. It might be an economic crisis. It's not necessarily a foreign policy crisis. And as we watch the candidates now, I mean, that is one thing we try to gauge, not in terms of what they say, but how they say it. That's something we try to gauge in terms of what kind of leadership they seem to exude. And that's going to be, you know, it could be a big issue that just swamps the other ones we've talked about.
Right. And the other ones, again, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, anti-American sentiments in the world, a need to reestablish international contacts, domestic issues like middle class insecurity, bridging the divide between the president and Congress, resolving the issues of immigration, and the unknown challenge of perhaps another September 11th, perhaps a huge financial economic blow. Those are the things that Julian Zelitzer says the next president can look into the past to find some lessons for. Julian, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School, best to you. And do you have a little celebration going today on President's Day?
Not really. I'm just working in my office.
We appreciate that you are. Julian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, we want to take a couple of minutes now for a brief thought on another lesson from a past president. I got my 14-year-old nephew a Sidekick for Christmas. These are those text message devices that are cheaper than phones, wildly popular with kids. His mother and I told him, don't take it to school. It will get stolen. The young salesman said, better buy insurance. These are so stolen. And sure enough, it was stolen. I knew something was up as soon as he called. Hey, Aunt Robin, how about I come by this afternoon? We haven't visited in a while. And oh, yeah, my Sidekick was stolen. But let's not tell my mom. She'll just worry. Oh, really? Come on over, I said. Let's review that strategy. We sat at my dining room table. Remember Richard Nixon, I began. Did you know that during the Vietnam era, he secretly bombed Cambodia without telling Americans? My nephew's eyes widened. Nixon's guys also spied on Democrats, and a guy named Daniel Ellsberg leaked these Pentagon papers, which revealed that U.S. leaders had long misled Americans about Vietnam. And then Nixon's men broke into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office to get some dirt on him. Then they broke into the Democratic Party offices in the Watergate. Really? My nephew said. Well, it went on like this for half an hour, how the burglars bungled the robbery, the subsequent Senate hearings, 18 minutes of erased tape, impeachment proceedings, and President Nixon resigning in shame before proceedings could be carried out. Now, I asked, why were impeachment proceedings started against Nixon? Because he secretly bombed Cambodia, my nephew said. No. Because he broke into the Watergate? Nope. Because he spied on people? No, I said. It was because he lied. Now, let's talk about your sidekick. We did, after which he went home and so passionately confessed the theft of his sidekick that his mother called me in shock. His exact words, "Mom, you were right, I was wrong, but remember, the cover-up is worse than the crime." Since then, it's become our mantra. Just yesterday, we were talking about how his sports hero, Roger Clemens, was innocent till proven guilty of steroid use, but my nephew sadly shook his head and without a trace of irony said, "Yeah, but still, the cover-up is worse than the crime." So I never thought I'd say this, but on this President's Day, a big thank you to Richard Nixon for giving us all a cautionary tale that may yet be learned by a new generation. Quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the shrinking dollar. It's bad for American tourists traveling to Europe, but what about American companies who want to do business there? That's tomorrow. Still ahead, how the foreclosure crisis is overwhelming animal shelters. You're listening to Here and Now. Schools may be closed on this President's Day, but public school officials are hard at work trying to find out whether the hamburger and meatloaf served in their school lunchroom is part of the largest beef recall in the U.S. Department of Agriculture history. Yesterday, the USDA called for the destruction of 143 million pounds of raw and frozen beef produced by the California-based Hallmark Meat Packing Company after the Humane Society made public a videotape of so-called downer cows in the company's slaughterhouse. A warning, the sound of these downer cows, cows too hurt or ill to walk, being forklifted, water hosed, and beaten before they are slaughtered, is difficult to listen to. Well, the Associated Press reports that nationwide about 150 school districts have now stopped using ground beef from Hallmark Meatpacking and its distributor, Westland, even though no illnesses from the meat have been reported. Agriculture officials say the health threat is small, it's more a humane issue, and most of the meat has probably already been consumed. And Kim Essex, spokesperson for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, is also trying to allay consumer fears.
As a mom who has two young children, I'm comfortable with the beef that is produced in this country. I believe it is safe.
But we called Dr. Michael Hansen, senior scientist at Consumers Union, to find out which schools bought the meat. He says he's not able to find out because the list of purchasers isn't publicly available.
Those distribution lists at the present time are considered confidential business information, and we feel that they should be. In the event of a recall, those lists should be made public immediately.
Hansen says the USDA has proposed making the information public. And the Humane Society says the real problem is the inadequacy of the inspection system. They ask, how can so many downer cows be mistreated day to day within a USDA oversight system? Well, the Humane Society's been busy. They've also been addressing the latest ripple effect of the nationwide housing crisis. Last year's foreclosure rate topped 2.2 million. And as families are forced from their homes, so are family pets. Overwhelming animal shelters. We spoke to two people at the center of this story. Michelle DeWeese is animal health care manager of the Rice County Humane Society in Minnesota, and Wayne Pacelli is president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States. We started with Wayne. I asked his reaction to this uptick in foreclosed pets.
Well, it is a shocking circumstance. I think it catches us by surprise in terms of its scope and its scale.
We're reading, for instance, in Brockton, Massachusetts, half the dogs brought in for surrender in January were because of foreclosures. In Orange County, Florida, nearly 700 pets given up in the last 4 months, and that's tripled 2 years ago. Michelle, what are some numbers from Minnesota?
Well, when we figured out our calculations, we only had part of January and we had all of December. We had 150 animals come in, and 51 were from foreclosures.
That's a lot.
Yeah, and it's not just dogs and cats either. We had ferrets and guinea pigs as well.
Salem, New Hampshire, the head of the shelter there says foreclosure separations are unlike anything she's seen before. What are you seeing?
We have owners that are so upset over their foreclosure that they're coming and visiting their pets every day until their dog was adopted by somebody else. You know, crying, the dog's, you know, upset because the people are upset.
Wayne, it would be like, you know, having to go off and live with relatives but leave a member of the family behind, throw away a member of the family.
Right, and I will also say that in many of these communities where foreclosures are really at a greater rate, they're exurban communities with fast suburban growth, and there may not be a very strong shelter network in some of these communities, so that compounds the problem.
Right.
Developed cities like New York City or San Francisco with very strong SPCAs or humane societies may be able to deal with that, but that's not where the acute foreclosure crisis is occurring.
Are you having an increase in euthanasia?
Well, I think it's inevitable. If you're having more animals come into the pipeline and there are the same number of adopters out there, then there's going to be more animals. And local shelters, whether they're public agencies, municipal or county, or private SPCAs or humane societies, are going to have to make tougher and tougher decisions. But we really insist that people not treat animals like a television set or a sofa. You can't just discard these animals when there are tough times. You have to hold on, just like you would hold on to any other family member. Now, there are difficult circumstances that may necessitate a person giving up the animal, but you've got to, you know, try to get a family member to take the animal, work with others in the community to place the animal, work with the shelter. But the shelters are overburdened in this country. It's certainly a better place to bring the animal than to leave the animals. We've seen it reported in a number of circumstances that people have simply left the animals in the home that's been foreclosed. That's an entirely irresponsible action.
Well, here are some other stats. Stanislaus County Humane Society in Northern California says property inspectors are finding dogs tied to trees, cats in garages, turtles and rabbits in kids' bedrooms when they go into an abandoned house. And I'm hearing very clearly from you, Wayne, that you're, you know, urging people to be responsible when they come into these financial situations, but again, Michelle, there in Minnesota, I mean, we're just hearing about shelters having to stock up with tissues because people are just heartbroken.
Well, one of the ones that I know that the owners were looking at her every day, her name was Sarabi. She was an older black lab. They came in every day to look at her. Sometimes we have them, they're so upset, they can't find anywhere for them to go that day, but a couple days later, somebody says, oh, okay, I'll take care of it, and they'll come back and get it.
Are shelters adjusting in this way, Wayne? Because, for instance, we understand the Worcester Animal Rescue League here in Worcester, Massachusetts, had so many cats and dogs from foreclosed homes that they decided to enact a new policy of holding the animals at the shelter at no cost for 90 days in the hopes that the owner could get housing.
Yes, it's a really, you know, smart move to compensate for the circumstances that they're seeing, because after their situation stabilizes in 60 or 90 days, a little bit more, maybe they can get the animal back. I think it's a very smart move. It's a continuing issue for local shelters. You know, they're always burdened by too many animals for too few homes. I think, you know, the solution rests with the public at large in terms of people making the right choices with pets, but also people acquiring animals from shelters rather than going to a pet store or an internet dealer or breeding more animals when we already have too many. Unfortunately, there are still nearly 4 million dogs and cats euthanized in shelters every year, and we could solve that problem if just a small percentage of Americans acquired their animals from shelters rather than going to a pet store or puppy mill.
Well, Wayne, I know there are websites. Shelters are listed at petfinder.com, and we'll have these linked at our website. But the Humane Society also has tips on finding homes for pets.
Yes, and, you know, one of the real problems that people face is a shortage of housing where pets are permitted. So we've got a website, rentwithpets.org. It's an online resource for rental managers and for pet owners, and gives you tips on finding pet-friendly housing situations.
That's Wayne Pacelli. He's president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States. He was speaking to us from Washington, D.C. And from Minnesota, Michelle DeWeese, animal health care manager of the Rice County Humane Society there in Minnesota. I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
And again, we'll have those websites at ours, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Randy Howe is a teacher, an American history buff, and a man with an infinite capacity for learning. How else can you explain that he happens to know that in the 1800s, presidential candidate James Garfield had a campaign song written in both English and German, the Veteran Song, or Die Stimme des Veteranen? Randy also knows that in 1900, the Republican Party rallying cry was, four more years of the dinner pail. Randy has taken these tidbits of information and, just in time for President's Day, created Presidential Brainiac, 600 historical facts and fascinating trivia about America's presidents and elections. He joins us from his home in Connecticut. Randy, what are some of your favorites?
I think the favorite is the fact that Martha Washington had a nickname for George, and that was Old Man. And what makes it even better is the fact that he wasn't older than her. He was a year younger. So she was poking a little bit of fun at him and also a little bit of fun at herself.
Are these little things you just, as a teacher, you came across, or did you actually go and look for?
Gems like that I stumbled upon. While looking for the basic information of who beat who in what election, you know, I might find a website or something in a book that would reveal a great little fact like that. Another one was that Pat Nixon, Pat was actually her nickname, and it's because she was born on St. Patrick's Day in 1912. So, you know, you never start out looking for something like that. You just kind of get lucky.
I have that card right here. It was Thelma Pat Nixon. Who remembered that her first name was Thelma? Let's actually play. You give me and our listeners some questions easy first, please.
Okay, yes.
We'll try
start out with the basics.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the cards in front of me here.
I have to say I'm terrible at this, so
preface it with this. Okay, this one I am sure that you will get. I've got faith.
Try me.
In what election year did the first televised debate take place?
Nixon, Kennedy.
Yep, got it.
And Nixon sweat.
Yep, that was one where Kennedy actually did better in the televised debate just because he looked better.
But people who only listened to it thought that Richard Nixon
right.
did better.
And what's that say about TV and televised debates, right?
And sweat. Okay. All right, let's keep going.
Okay, now we will move up to an intermediate card. What is the most common religion among U.S. presidents?
Protestantism?
It is Episcopalian, and Presbyterian came in second. You're in the right ballpark. It's the, you know, the wealthy white guy religion. You know, pick any of those and you're going to be close, right?
Well, it isn't hard since I think we had our first Catholic president with John F. Kennedy, and we have not had a president of any other faith since, Jewish or Muslim. So,
it's a distinguished group, but there isn't a lot of diversity there.
Okay.
Okay, now we move on to the advance. Who was the first president to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize?
Jimmy Carter.
It goes farther back than that. He was awarded this prize in 1906.
Oh, well, that would have to be 1906. Let me think. Let's see. After Madison, before FDR.
Now, FDR, if we were little kids playing the game, I'd say, all right, you're getting warmer.
Theodore.
Yep.
Oh, yes. Remind us why.
Roosevelt won the Nobel for his work on the Russo-Japanese Treaty, in which they settled their dispute over possession of Korea and Manchuria.
I'm flipping through some more. Which president was the first to be a Rhodes Scholar?
The first Rhodes Scholar, I believe, was William Jefferson Clinton.
There you have it. Which Roaring Twenties president began his inaugural address, "My countrymen, no one can contemplate current conditions without finding much that is satisfying, still more that is encouraging."
The encouraging president was Calvin Coolidge.
Yes, you are right. Bing. Okay. And here's one. Which First Lady's loyalty was questioned during the Civil War, as she had several relatives that sided with the South?
That was poor Mary.
Todd Lincoln.
Yep, she's an interesting person. A lot was going on in her life, and that was one that I did not know before starting to do these cards.
Huh. Randy, as you flip through the cards, we're in another presidential campaign. I'm wondering if you're already jotting down interesting little tidbits to go on future cards.
I am definitely taking note. You know, thinking in particular of Obama and Clinton and McCain, you really couldn't ask for three more interesting people, whether it was the former First Lady or the fellow who was born in Hawaii and has such an international background, or the stately senator who actually survived a prisoner of war camp and is still going strong in his 70s. These are very interesting, trivia-worthy people.
30 years from now, some child will pull that card and say, "You're kidding, there was a presidential candidate, perhaps president, who was prisoner of war."
Right.
It's fun to think of that and the other facts that you mentioned. Randy Howe, creator of Presidential Brainiac, 600 historical facts and fascinating trivia about America's presidents and elections. Randy, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Back in 1 minute with climber Ed Viesters here and now. There are 14 mountains in the world that are over 8,000 meters high. They are the world's tallest peaks. Fewer than 20 people have climbed them all, and only a handful have done so without using supplemental oxygen. Well, Ed Viesters was the first American to accomplish that feat. Viesters and his co-author and fellow climber David Roberts write about the world of mountain climbing in the book No Shortcuts to the Top, Climbing the World's 14 Highest Peaks. It details the rigors and risks of climbing these mountains. We spoke to Ed when the book was first published. I have to cut right to the chase because a compelling read, and yet I don't think I've ever read a sport book, in essence, that is so much about death. I mean, the bodies that you're nodding yes, you're nodding as if you've heard this.
Well, I understand it. I mean, and I look at what I've experienced in my life and this game we play or this sport we're involved in, and I've lost friends and partners, and they died climbing as I was. If you rationalize it and think about it, you go, why would you want to do that? And, you know, I chose to do it a long time ago. I liked the challenge. And then I also felt that maybe I could do it differently. Maybe I could somehow, by being more thoughtful, more careful, more conservative, be safer. My goal was to come home, not to just go to the top.
In fact, what's your motto?
Well, getting to the summit is optional and getting down is mandatory. You know, getting to the summit is half the climb. And a lot of people lose sight of the fact that you still have to come down. You know, they get to the top, they think it's all over, yahoo, but the descent is more important, in fact.
And reading through, you put it in a very unsentimental way, a lot of your observations about climbs, in particular where you saw people perish or heard about people who had perished on other climbs. And in a very sort of straightforward way, you write about what you might have done differently. Now, some would see that and wince and say, oh, is he being critical of climbers that in other places you've professed to love, but then here you are, you know, critiquing them maybe.
I'm not sure if I was critical. I would just, people often ask me to justify what I was doing, and that's my way of justifying it. Not to say that I was Teflon coated and was immune to the dangers, but most of the accidents and most of the deaths that occur in the mountains are self-inflicted by making bad judgments or by pushing harder and further and longer than is reasonable. So in my way of looking at it, that's simply a way for me to justify what I continue to do and why I continue to do it.
Well, also maybe to learn from it. You've climbed Everest. How many times have you climbed?
Six times to the summit.
Yeah. But listeners know you were featured in David Brashear's IMAX film about the mountain, which was, of course, shot in May of 1996, mm-hmm. which I don't know if your heart flops when you hear that date.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's something probably I think about or talk about almost every day.
This is when a snowstorm claimed the lives of eight climbers, two of them friends of yours. In particular, Rob Hall, and this was just excruciating to read because he lived for a day on the mountain. And what was your role with him?
He was trapped at 28,700 feet. He somehow survived one night sitting out there in the storm. And the next morning, it was around 5 in the morning, the radio crackled to life, and it was Rob. Since I was one of his closest friends, I got on the radio, and intermittently, for about 6 hours, I talked to him. And I think my job, or people were hoping that I could maybe get him excited enough or even to yell at him to get him up and moving to start working his way down the mountain. And I also told him jokes, anything that I could kind of liven up the day a little bit. And in the meantime, several times during that, you know, we connected his wife to him via satellite telephone. Ugh. And we would overhear those conversations and we would be in tears listening to that. And then I'd have to get back on the radio with this really, you know, strong front and say, come on, Rob, get moving.
Yeah, and yet it didn't work.
No, he couldn't move. He was frostbitten. He was debilitated by the cold and lack of oxygen. And the second night, he simply, you know, went to sleep and never woke up again. And I think we all knew that's what was going to happen. And I think he himself, you know, he was a smart guy. He knew as well. And, you know, I think about that. Imagine sitting somewhere contemplating your death and knowing that tonight, when you fall asleep, you won't wake up again.
Yeah, and knowing that you have a wife at home. And that's what surprises me at Edvesters, because in reading the book and reading that you co-authored it with David Roberts. Now, David Roberts has been on this program several times. He's written a book, which was, I guess, pretty controversial. We heard from a lot of climbers. Coming to the conclusion that climbing is unfair to families. He realized that it put his loved ones in a terrible position, and he wasn't willing to do that anymore. You write in your book about getting married, having kids. I thought you were going to come to that same conclusion. I thought you're shaking your head no.
No. Again, I think, like I said, the reason that I justified what I was doing was how I was doing it. And when I met my wife, she never asked me to stop climbing. She knew this is what I was. This is the guy she fell in love with. And even when I had children, I might have become more conservative.
Well, in fact, you say that. You say that you did.
And that's fine. And I'm so glad that I'm sitting here today because of that. There are situations where there's nothing you can do about it. You know, a random occurrence that you cannot manage. But I truly believe that a lot of the problems that occur are because of bad decision-making in the mountains.
Well, as interesting as the many times you climbed are the times you didn't, that you turned back and just said, oh, no. And that's hard to see, too. I mean, months of preparation, months, you know, on location, getting to a certain point. You're on the mountain. You're just not at the summit, and we're going back.
Yeah, and the conditions were saying, listen, it's not good for you to go on. And what I have termed it as I was listening to the mountain. And when my instincts were telling me something was wrong, it was wrong. And I would just simply stop and walk away.
There's one story that you tell, and this was when you were a guide on Mount Rainier. And this is not this is what some people would say is just kind of, you know, an easier thing to climb. And there's a guy who walks past you. Tell the story, because it was remarkable. He walks past you one day.
We were guiding on Mount Rainier. This was 10 years ago, and we had very warm weather, even above 14,000 feet, and it had rained, and then everything froze. So the whole mountain became this literal sheet of ice, and we had taken our clients to a point at about 13,000 feet, and we decided it was unsafe to continue with our guided group. So
what's the summit there?
14,000
oh, yeah.
feet.
Uh-huh.
And as we were there making this decision to turn around, a solo climber passed me, and I mentioned to him, you know, be very careful. It's extremely dangerous. And as he passed me, he simply said, it's only Mount Rainier. Hmm. 10 minutes later, as he had climbed above me, he slipped and fell and slid very quickly down the slope. Unable to stop himself, he came flying past me and literally took me out as he flew past.
Sitting up, looking down the hill with a look of horror on his face.
With a look of horror. And I'll remember that look of horror on his face for as long as I live. And he continued down the mountain for several thousand feet and ended up dead in a crevasse. And I remember we climbed down to make sure, to see perhaps he was still alive. Was there anything we could do? And as I looked at him and I thought, you know, it's only Mount Rainier. You know, mountains are mountains, whether they're 14,000 feet or 29,000 feet. And there's something that Lou Whitaker, one of my mentors, says, you know, just because you love the mountains doesn't mean they love you.